from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
The sun is rising in the west, and the arc of history is bending in our direction. Because this is not just a state of resistance. California is a state of results.
Today in Sacramento, Gavin Newsom is set to be sworn in as the 40th governor of California. He's taking over a predicted $15 billion budget surplus and has a three-fourths ultra-democratic majority. What results will Governor Newsom seek to achieve for California? We'll discuss that and more next, after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Today in Sacramento, Gavin Newsom is set to be sworn in as the 40th governor of California, and he takes over a state flush with a $14.5 billion rainy day fund and a projected budget surplus of $10 billion or more. But Newsom also inherits a state experiencing a housing crisis, rising income inequality, and a growing vulnerability to wildfires. The statehouse will be stacked in Newsom's favor with a three-quarters ultra-democratic majority. Meanwhile, the California Republican Party will be forced to do some soul-searching about if and how it will rebuild itself. Tell us, what are your hopes or fears for California under Governor Gavin Newsom? And you can call us now at our toll-free number. That number is 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org. We're talking with our senior editor, KQED's California Government and Politics Desk, Scott Schaefer, who is up there in Sacramento. Democratic strategist is with us as well. And let me first say hello to Scott. Scott, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Michael.
And let me say good morning to Democratic strategist and founder of Close the Gap California, Mary Hughes, who's here in studio. Mary, good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
And good morning to Republican strategist Sean Walsh of Wilson Walsh Consulting. Good morning, Sean.
Thank you.
Glad to have all of you with us this morning. And Sean, let me begin with you. Actually, I'm sorry, Scott, let me begin with you. And then we'll go to Mary and Sean. Let's just begin by kind of laying out the lay of the land here. It would appear at this point that Gavin Newsom is going into this with a whole new set of priorities, with a different style of governing, and with a pretty full coffers, to put it mildly, but also a lot of campaign promises.
He is, and of course, I think you'd rather come into office with a lot of money in the bank. I mean, Jerry Brown inherited a $27 billion deficit, and he's leaving $14 billion in the rainy day fund and, you know, a lot of extra money in the budget as well. So he does have a big vision and big goals. He talked about that during the campaign. He's already released bits of his budget, which show a $2 billion investment in childhood education, child care. He wants to expand free community college to a second year. Now, of course, as you point out, all those things are expensive. We haven't seen the price tags yet, just the description of the policies. And of course, the legislature will have a lot to do with this, and the economy will have a lot to do with it as well. We've seen some real turbulence on Wall Street and in some of the markets around the world. And so that has to be a cautionary note for the new governor. And I think he's also going to be very mindful, Gavin Newsom will be, of not blowing it, of not just spending the money and developing a reputation for not being able to manage a budget well. He does have huge majorities of Democrats in the legislature, you can be sure. I imagine Sean Walsh will be happy to tell you that Democrats have a big appetite for spending, and they're going to have their own priorities, some of which will overlap with the new governor. But this will be a new set of priorities. It'll be interesting to see what he says today in his inaugural speech and what he says in the coming days and weeks and months about things like high-speed rail and the Twin Tunnels and the Delta, which were priorities for Jerry Brown, but they may not be for Gavin Newsom.
Well, I want to talk about his priorities and talk about them with you, but here he is talking about the challenges many state residents face as they seek the California dream.
But let's be honest, there's no doubt about this. The dream is still too distant for too many. We're a land of plenty, but we are far from perfect. Too many Californians are being priced out of housing, of health care, and higher education. Too many workers are feeling the ever-tightening squeeze of automation and wage stagnation. Too many children are growing up in poverty and starting school from behind. in many ways, in many places, we are simultaneously the richest and the poorest state.
That kind of lays it out there, Scott, and I think many of the promises that have been made are sort of implicit in what we just heard. He, in fact, said ironclad, single payer to the nurses union.
He did, but, you know, he has also been a little more, shall we say, realistic about that in recent months. He would like to make progress on that. But I think the nurses understand, too, that there isn't going to be single payer health care in California this year or maybe even next year or the year after that. But they want to see some progress. And I think Newsom is committed to at least giving it a shot. What I think you're going to see, really, that'll be the biggest difference between the outgoing Brown administration and the Newsom administration is the focus on children. He has, of course, four young children himself. That in and of itself is a big optics difference from Jerry Brown, who does not have any kids. And we've seen those kids front and center over the weekend at various events that the governor-elect has held.
And excuse me, Scott, the Newsom family is moving to Sacramento.
They are. I think they struggled with that because they didn't want to uproot the kids from school in Marin, but they're going to be moving into the mansion in downtown Sacramento. I was talking to Gavin Newsom an hour or so ago, and he said he'd only been in there once. It's a little odd to be moving into a house that you barely know, but that's what they're going to be doing, I think, even later today.
Let me just ask a couple of things that might distinguish him from his predecessor, Jerry Brown. One thing that seems to be in the offing, aside from the concern about childhood education and about community colleges and health care and so forth, is also an environmental concern, because Jerry Brown was okay with fracking. He was okay to a great extent with oil drilling. Not so clear that Gavin Newsom's going to follow suit, is it?
Well, I think, yeah, there's going to be certainly pressure on him from the so-called keep it in the ground lobby. They don't want to see any oil extracted from California. Now, I think Jerry Brown has taken a more, shall we say, realistic perspective on that, saying that, look, if we don't take it out of the ground, people are still going to drive their cars. There's still going to be a demand for oil. It'll just be shipped in from other states, and that has its own environmental risks as well. So I think you may see this new governor back away from fracking a little bit, maybe put more regulations on it or even ban it, as they've done in some states. But I'm not sure that's going to be necessarily a top priority. And the oil industry, for all of its problems, and there are many environmentally speaking, it does provide a lot of jobs and a lot of revenue for counties like, Kern County, even L.A. County, some of those counties that, are really big in oil production. I think California is the second biggest oil producing state in the country.
We can expect him to continue to be head of the resistance, as the New Yorker put it?
Well, certainly in his speech today, we've seen excerpts of it. He is going to lay out a strong contrast between California, which is open to immigrants, open to new ideas, embracing diversity. He has found a pretty good foil in Donald Trump, who is, of course, extremely unpopular in California. But he's going to have to do more than that. And as Jerry Brown quickly figured out, you need the federal government at times, especially in a state like California, which is prone to one disaster or another. And so I would imagine he'll pick his battles. You do have to pick up the phone sometimes and ask for an emergency declaration or emergency funding from the White House. So you don't want to, you don't want to burn that bridge. And I should say that his ex-wife, Kimberly Guilfoyle, is also dating Donald Trump Jr., so that might be a back channel into the Oval Office.
Scott Schaefer, again, a senior editor at KQED's California Government and Politics Desk. And Mary Hughes is a Democrat strategist and founder of Close the Gap California. And how do you think it's going to work out between this governor and the legislature? There was a kind of aloofness that was often associated with Gavin Newsom, not quite the schmoozer that people think Jerry Brown was.
I think this governor will engage well earlier in the policymaking than Governor Brown did, who tended to lay back, wait to see what was formulated, and then make his decisions. I think Governor Newsom has signaled with the more family-friendly agenda, which is very much aligned with the influx of new women into the legislature, that there is a path forward with the Democrats to make quick, solid, concrete advancements, which every governor wants to do early and which this legislature will also want to do.
Now, you see Governor Brown is working particularly hard, for example, on ameliorating the homelessness problem, although often that's in the realm more of city and county government than it is of state government. But you think he's really going to maybe push hard as he did as mayor?
Well, I think the top priorities for Governor Newsom will be in the realm, as Scott said, if somewhat focused on children. I think the health care initiatives will begin first with children. Early childhood education is clear. They've made that central. Parental leave is a bolder move. 6 months is the goal. So I do think that those are initiatives that he will engage in quickly.
Where's the money for 6 months?
You know, we do have a reserve. I think he's being very careful about how he allocates that. So it's unclear where he'll move money. And I also think, as Scott said, it will take a longer time to achieve these things. But some of them we can begin now.
Let me get a caller on here, and that's you, Peter, from Berkeley. Join us.
Hey, how's it going?
Thank you for asking. Okay. How are you?
I'm good. So I was just listening in. Thanks. I love what you guys do. I really appreciate having this journalism going on in the local radio. I guess I just wanted to say when people like me, I'm like kind of a left-leaning Democrat, we see Gavin Newsom look the part. He definitely says all the right things. But, you know, I've been in Berkeley for 25 years, and I've watched the tech shadow loom further and further, and I've watched, the homeless situation go kind of out of control. And my concern is that while he might seem on the surface like the right kind of politician for California, it's just it's really easy to be the anti-Trump but still kind of stay in the center and keep things, the wheels greased. And I know that Gavin Newsom's really connected. I know the billionaire class helps him in his policy and his politics. So for us, we're just kind of concerned that it's going to be a lot more of the same and, you know, things moving at a snail's pace for renewables and things that are really important, like single payer and, you know, the environment.
Well, you're expressing some concerns and apprehensions. Mary Hughes, you want to direct your response to his concerns?
Yeah, I think one of the things that it will be really interesting to watch is the freedom that this governor now has. He's been a lieutenant governor for 8 years. He had a contentious run as mayor in San Francisco, wasn't always with the left. The agenda that we see so far would suggest that he is interested in making moves quickly. I think he's very mindful that trends and ideas move West Coast to East, and there is a great premium both politically but also in terms of policy implementation on actually trying things. I don't think it will be a laboratory, but we're going to see bolder experiments, a return in some ways to pilot projects, using multiple departments to attack a problem. So homelessness, for example, one of the initiatives I expect to see early on in the healthcare movement is mental health. How will that take a chunk out of our homeless problem, and also find funding? You were asking about funding, Michael. I think we're going to see various departments contribute to bigger solutions for problems that are big. And in the beginning, a governor gets a little leeway to be bolder. So I think you'll see that.
Plus, he's a risk taker. He's known for being innovative and so forth. But what about, I'd like to get your synopsis on what you think is going to happen vis-a-vis the aftermath of the fires and what kind of steps he's going to take innovatively there.
Well, I think we need a comprehensive program, not just for fire, but for all of our potential natural disasters. We are mindful, but not always, about how precariously we live here on the West Coast. And I think that disaster preparedness is not sexy. It won't be at the top of the list. But I do think that it's something that he will attend to. The immediate aftermath of the fire will require, as Scott referenced, a cooperation with the federal government to come after these things and change the way we plant. May take some changes in zoning. We may want to treat people who live in fire zones the way we treat people who live in flood zones. So I think there'll be some policy changes in how we prepare for this future.
Sean Walsh, let's bring you into this. Sean Walsh, again, is a Republican strategist, Sean Walsh of Wilson Walsh Consulting. And Republicans, barely a quarter of the legislature now. I mean, still got some money for political purposes, but not going to like the spending, as was alluded to earlier, that may go forward?
I don't think so. And their numbers are so small that I think they're only a voice, not necessarily a vote or a policy block for anything that moves down the pike. I do think be careful what you wish for, because when you get all of the money that you're hoping for and you get all of the political numbers that you're hoping for, sometimes, certainly oftentimes in politics, you can overreach, overstretch, and then political consequences come back. And I think that's what it's going to take for the Republicans. This is not a fix for the Republican Party in 5 years or 10 years. This is really a 20-year program, and the Republicans are going to have to evolve, and hopefully they evolve, continue as a Republican Party and not have to evolve into something else.
Well, eventually, it's often predictable that a party that's in power does often fall into abuse or things along those lines. So the GOP would be looking for some kind of opening, but it has to kind of rebuild itself. It has to come out of the ashes, doesn't it?
Well, it does. I mean, Governor Schwarzenegger said, you know, you're dying at the box office. And to a certain extent, they were. But what it requires is actually leaders who are there that were going to do the hard spade work to actually find candidates that are going to run at the school board level and the city council level and then move up through the legislature and beyond. And I'm not sure we've done as good a job at doing that. I'm not sure we've reached out to the various changing demographic communities and found the best candidates that are possible there as well. Republicans historically have either funded from businesses or self-funded in many respects. The Democrats have had significant advantages because they've funded heavily from labor unions. And so I think the Republicans are going to have to change the dynamic and how they actually run from very top to bottom from a finance perspective and a candidate recruitment perspective.
Well, according to Cal Matters, Republicans now are more white. They're more Trumpian. I think I'm using their language, not my own here. And perhaps younger in to many degree. But the state is less purple. It's just more hard blue.
More hard blue. And I will say, though, I do think there's hope from the Republican Party. I know folks say that Republicans have alienated Latino voters with regards to people coming into the country illegally. And there is a pretty non-monolithic segment of the Hispanic population, significant numbers who do not favor undocumented immigrants coming into the country. They favor a regulated legal system. Many of them came in from a regulated legal perspective. So I do think there is, from a policy perspective, if we don't use harsh rhetoric, the ability to, from a policy perspective, right versus wrong, attract Latinos back to the Republican Party and attract them, too, since they are the fastest segment of growing businesses in the state of California, particularly in areas that are actually hard hit financially where the highest poverty levels are.
Here's a caller. Chitra, join us. Good morning. You're on the air.
My name is Chitra. I'm calling from Fremont. Again, I have the same concern about illegal immigration. I think California spends a lot of money on illegal immigrants and DACA kids. I'm worried for my children who will not even probably not get accepted to UCs when it's time to apply. Sure. Immigrants, not only are they accepted, their tuition is paid, even the board is paid. So I think it's unfair.
Oh, thank you for that call, Chitra. In fact, they're already talking about the possibility of covering universal coverage, which would include undocumented. Sean, these are concerns of your party and certainly concerns of the party that's out.
Well, they should be concerns for the whole country. So I read an article in Scientific American, I think, last week that showed for the first time there was a pepper-picking robot machine that would go into the fields, cut the peppers, pull them off, put them into the stacking conveyor belt and put them off. And they were saying, well, it's not very good. It's only 61% efficient with regards to picking ripe peppers. It then went on to highlight the fact that there's a strawberry picking robot machine that's out there as well. And I think this is endemic of what the state really needs to think about is that the whole technology is changing. It's much like Europe, England in the 1870s and 1880s, where technology changed the workforce. And so we have got to decide how many people are going to come in, what type of population we have, what kind of education system we need to have there, because automation's not going away. And so when Governor Newsom says, well, or any politician says, I just want to let people in, open borders, we're going to pay for everything we have, at some juncture, the jobs are not going to be there, and you need to have a high-quality, skilled workforce. And we need to make tough public policy decisions that also have political ramifications.
Michael, you want to address that? This notion that Democrats are saying that they're for open borders, I just don't. I'd like to see some of the data on that or the specifics. I know that's a good talking point, but I think the issues around border security are much more nuanced. It's not a question of are you in favor of open borders or not. It's how do you secure the border? I think that's really what the discussion is.
It keeps coming up here, Scott, and I want to ask Sean directly. Can you point to any Democrat who has said we need open borders? We want open borders?
Yeah, actually, the fact that they don't want to put up any sort of barrier system along the border. In the past, they supported the Secure Fence Act of 1986, which was a fence that had a border barrier. And now that they don't want to allow for any financing for any border issue, you're not going to keep people from coming into the country just simply by saying we're going to have policies that, like we did with the Immigration Reform and Control Act with Ronald Reagan when he allowed people into the country, saying we're going to just check their IDs and make sure we're not going to give them jobs. So you need to have a fence, kind of like what Israel has, or some sort of barrier, and then you need the technology in place, so then you can then have a regulated immigration system. So the absence of the fact that Democrats are willing to take concrete actions to secure the borders is basically an open border policy. So it's a de facto policy.
You say what to that, Mary Hughes?
Well, President Obama did not have an open border policy, but I think that there's a lot of posturing, especially in the shadow of the current discussion and shutdown about the border wall. So I think any comments today or any comments recently about this have been in that context. What we fail to understand is the big picture. What we need to do is through foreign aid, investment, trade, fortify the governments and the economies of our neighbors. If Mexico and Central America experience the same economy as Canada, this issue would not be an issue. But we do not see the world that way.
We could have a vigorous debate on this, and yes, we have had many. But let me go back, because we're coming up on a break here. And Scott, can you give us kind of an update on what's going on in Washington? I mean, as far as the shutdown, I think it's a good time maybe to hear from you on this.
Well, there were talks over the weekend. There are various and somewhat conflicting reports as to whether progress was made. The problem for Republicans in the Senate is that every time Vice President Pence or some other emissary from the administration floats a deal that Democrats accept, the Trump administration or the president really specifically backs away. And so I think there's going to be some reluctance to really vote on something before the president says he's going to sign it, because why go out on a limb if you're a Republican or a Democrat? Especially if you're a Republican, if the president is going to change his mind after he's agreed to something through his vice president.
Well, he seems to be talking about steel rather than concrete now. I mean, we've gone into another orbit of discussion here. But in the meantime, let me invite our listeners to join us. We're talking about, of course, Gavin Newsom becoming governor of California officially today. And you may want to weigh in with your thoughts. Teresa tweets, "My hope is that our new governor will listen to families like mine about the crisis of California's great health disparity, serious mental illness. My fear is that he will listen to the mental health advocates who have allowed jail streets and graveyards to fill with our gravely disabled kids." Another listener tweets, "My wish list, holding PG&E accountable for mass murder, universal transitional kindergarten, repeal Prop 13, reboot the UC agents, and free two-year colleges." Well, you can bring in your own wish list here. What are your expectations? What are your apprehensions? We want to hear from you. Toll-free number 866-733-6786 or email forum at kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about Gavin Newsom's ascendancy to the governorship of California. He's become the 40th governor officially and is in Sacramento going through his inauguration today, as well as all of the rituals and procedures attendant upon those taking the highest executive office here in California. And with us in studio, Mary Hughes, who is with the Democratic Party. She's a Democrat strategist and founder of Close the Gap California. And Sean Walsh, member of the Republican Party and a Republican strategist for Wilson Walsh Consulting, and our own senior editor of KQED's California Government and Politics desk, Scott Schaefer. Scott, I want to just touch on one other thing, because we got a lot of callers here and I want to get to as many as we can. But I was talking about ways that Governor Newsom is going to take perhaps a departure. And one of the things that he's been very strong on, and came under a lot of fire from the NRA is a strong stance when it comes to at least doing something about guns. I heard a very poignant exchange he had with a young child in Fresno, young school children, who said, how can you make us safe? And he tried to reassure her that the government would do as much as they can, and he would do as much as he could personally to make her safe. But what do you anticipate? What do you expect?
Well, I think there are some bills that Governor Brown vetoed around guns and gun shows. For example, there was a bill I believe Scott Wiener carried to ban gun shows at the Cow Palace. Governor Brown vetoed that. I think you'll see legislation like that come back. I mean, and probably get signed by Governor Newsom. You know, Jerry Brown, his theory generally has always been sort of paddle once on the right, once on the left, keep the canoe going forward down the middle. And he vetoed quite a few. I mean, he signed more gun legislation than he vetoed, for sure. But he also disappointed some of the gun control advocates in some of the vetoes that he did give to bills that crossed his desk. So, you know, this has obviously been an issue that has been high on the agenda for Governor Newsom. Lieutenant Governor Newsom, and I would imagine it'll remain that way when he gets into the governor's office.
Well, talk about what's high on his agenda. Angie writes, those of us who care about early child care and education are excited that Governor Newsom is going to make it one of his top priorities. If there is an infusion of funding, we will be able to have women go back to work, children ready for school, and to reduce poverty in the state. Mary Hughes, pretty much in line with what you're hoping, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think there are Senator Holly Mitchell, who's been the budget chair, was quick to say that this was a departure from trains and tunnels. It's an investment in people. It's welcome. It marks a real departure as a marquee issue. It sort of sets goals. And this family-friendly approach, I believe, will be more popular than on first blush.
He has to legally submit a budget by January 10th, and that prompts me to read a note here from a listener named Rich and get your response, Sean. Rich says, this governor has the enormous budget surplus because the legislature and the voters foolishly raised taxes in very significant ways. Gavin will use up this surplus and more with his appetite for well-meaning but impossibly expensive ideas. We are going to regret one-party rule in Sacramento.
Well, I agree that I'll take it from the back end first. I do think you'll regret one-party rule in Sacramento, number one. Again, I just think it allows for things to get railroaded through. And if you think about it, $1,000, $1,000 is a million, and $1,000 million is a billion. And we talk about expanding child care services to a million or plus kids, depending on how you do it. A lot of the labor unions would like to see certified teachers, and those teachers then get on the public employee union dole. It gets very, very expensive very, very fast. And you'd say, how do you blow through I think it's going to be $17 billion surplus actually when finance releases their numbers next week. You've got
the bills are already over $40 billion, by
the way. So and what people don't realize is, you know, Jerry Brown's getting patted on the back for his great fiscal restraint, but he quietly increased public employee benefits and salaries by $4 billion. That's $22,000 for public employee across the state.
And we have a pension problem in this state. There's
we
no
do.
Doubt about
and
it.
And so actually a lot of the money that the legislature spent in the last term of Governor Brown has it's these little programs here, $1,000 here, $1,000 there, and like they said in Congress, $1 billion here, $1 billion there. It adds up. So if the state turns upside down and we do not actually have a reform of the way we actually collect taxes in the state of California, you could be headed for a catastrophic, I think, budget problem in 2-3 years.
Mary Hughes, you want to say something here, and then we'll get to our callers. Go ahead.
I do. I think we forget when we make these investments up front that they are integral to California continuing to be the economic engine of the country. Workforce readiness, educational competitiveness, these things make us attractive to businesses, and that is critical.
Let's get some more callers on. Let's go to El Cerrito. Ruth Ann, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I have you all's ear. I never had Governor Brown's ear. And if I did, I would have told him to be very fiscally conservative. He should have supported single-payer health care, but there wasn't a prayer that he was going to do that. What I'm wondering is what the panel thinks of the chances of Gavin Newsom supporting it. I mean, he did go out on a limb, and I can't get into his brain either, of reading the tea leaves when he went out on a limb on same-sex marriage, and endorsed it for San Francisco. California went that way, and so went the rest of the country. I think single payer would be much better if it was national with H.R. 676. But since that isn't happening today or tomorrow, I think second best would be going state by state. And I don't know what you all think of the odds of Gavin Newsom supporting single payer for California.
Well, Ruth, thank you for the question. I think it's pretty clear that Gavin Newsom does support single payer. Although, Scott, isn't there talk in Sacramento now about something incremental like universal coverage before the move to single payer?
Yeah, I mean, the number of hurdles, economic and political, to getting to single payer are enormous. I mean, Vermont looked at it years ago, and I think Vermont is about as progressive a state as there is, certainly on the East Coast, and they abandoned it because it was unworkable. I mean, and let's not forget, even if you could get to the point where the legislature passed something that the governor signed, you'd still need to get a waiver from the president. So that would seem to be unlikely. We don't have time to get into it here, but we spend about $400 billion a year in California on health care, and that includes what employers pay to cover their employees. And so what would happen is employers would suddenly, instead of paying the insurance companies, they'd have to give their check to the state, because the state would be the single payer, the single provider. And you can imagine the difficulties that would be inherent in creating a system like that. I think what you'll see is the governor appoint some sort of a commission with unions and business and healthcare experts and insurance folks to try to move the ball down the field, or at least to make it look that way. But it is really a very difficult hurdle to clear, and I'm sure Gavin Newsom knows that.
Well, Scott, I just so happen to have here a cut from you talking about single-payer health care with Gavin Newsom. Let's hear.
Everyone talks about the price tag of single-payer without talking about the price tag of the status quo. You can eliminate a lot of those burdens and your co-pays, and you can eliminate your premiums with a single-payer plan. No one really talks about that. And so we got to find a balance in this conversation.
Sort of echoing what you were saying before, Scott. I just wanted to...
Yeah, exactly. He's clear-eyed, I think, about what the challenges would be. And also, you put California on the hook for healthcare costs that you don't control. You can't control what pharmaceutical companies and hospitals and others provide, a charge to provide these services. And there's a huge percentage of Californians, for example, already on Medi-Cal, which is essentially single payer. Whether or not the economy is doing well, you'd still be on the hook for those costs. So it could be potentially extremely disruptive. Now, some would say, yeah, it needs to be disrupted. But nonetheless, it could be a catastrophic problem if it isn't implemented correctly, even if we did get a waiver from the federal government.
And here's Aaron. Aaron, thank you for waiting. Join us. You're on the air. Aaron, are you there?
Hello?
Aaron?
Yeah.
Yeah. Hi. Yeah. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing? Thanks for having me. I was wondering if you could comment on what you think Gavin Newsom may or may not do with regard to California's sanctuary city laws. I think as evidence to Democrats' open border support is SB 56, I think it was, that protects, that prevents California police officers from cooperating with federal agencies on illegal immigrants, especially those that already have felony convictions in America.
Now, let me get right to the point here, I think, with you, Mary Hughes. Gavin Newsom is very strong on sanctuary state and supporting sanctuary state.
Yes, he is. And I think that he will hold up to that. People often don't make the distinction between the sanctuary policies, which allow for cooperation when there is a violent felony involved. And I think that exception is really a linchpin in many ways for people being able to say, yes, sanctuary makes good sense. People shouldn't be harassed. We don't want families who are here without proper legality to be harassed. So we have taken this position, and I would expect it to continue.
It's a weakness for this majority party, though, in many ways, isn't it, from your perspective, Sean Walsh?
Well, I think so. I mean, Kate Steinle here in San Francisco, you've got Mr. Singh, who was killed in the Central Valley. Like any policy, if it's not implemented properly, people shouldn't be harassed for helping to actually solve crimes, but they go so far as to have criminals in jail and they won't identify the criminal and turn them over to the federal government for deportation. That's bad policy. It's dangerous policy. And if the state of California doesn't implement sanctuary cities properly, I think the federal government would do a preemption and probably knock the state and other states out from doing that. And that's probably what should happen.
And Scott, let me go back to you for a moment. Can you give us a quick outline of some of the people that the governor has already named? Lenny Mendoza, for example, is now chair of the Bay Area Council, was named head of the business, doing business advising to the new governor. And he's also named Anna Matasantos and so forth.
Matasantos, right. Yeah, these are people who are
These are old players, basically. I mean, to use the word old and veteran players in this, right?
Yeah, that's a better word, Michael. They're people who are well known to people in the Capitol, people like Daniel Zingali, who worked for Gray Davis when he was controller and then when he was governor, and also worked for Maria Shriver when she was first lady. Ann O'Leary, who actually used to be on KQED's board, who is going to be, I believe, his chief of staff. I mean, these are folks she ran. Mary Hughes would know better than I, but I believe she ran Hillary Clinton's campaign in California in 2016. These are folks who are well-known both in Sacramento and in the policy arenas that they work in. Angie Wei from the California Federation of Labor. People who I think send a signal that he is putting in place people who are familiar with how the Capitol works. And obviously Gavin Newsom doesn't have a lot of experience in Sacramento. Even as lieutenant governor, he wasn't up here very often. But he's putting people in place who do know how this city, this town, this building works.
These are policy wonks in many respects, and pragmatists too, aren't they, for the most part?
Well, some of them are. But I think when you put them all in the scale, you have a combination of people who know, like Aunt, you mentioned Anna Matasantos, who was budget director for Arnold Schwarzenegger, I believe, and you know she knows how to put together a budget and how to balance a budget and. Someone who is well-known within the Department of Finance. He's also keeping the current head of the Department of Finance in place. So there will be, you know, this is a time of change, but it's going to be a kind of familiar change, I think.
But if I could, Michael,
yeah, Mary,
I think one of the things that's very interesting about some of the people that Scott named, Ann O'Leary, the chief of staff, for example, has experience with Children's Health in the Clinton administration and was a policy director for Hillary Clinton. Daniel Zingali is coming back to government from the California Endowment, deep interest in health policy. Angie Wei, one of the chief advocates for single payer. So many of these people, Lenny Mendoza, who you mentioned, while he's the co-chair of California Forward and a former McKinsey partner, he has been one of the most vocal advocates for taking a look at the downside of California's wealth divide and income divide and what it would take to close that. So these are experienced people. They're also people with a point of view and values-based and experience and depth in substantive policy.
Yeah, I like experience, like veteran more than old, but people who have been around for a while. I got Anthony Williams, for example, who worked under Daryl Steinberg with legislative affairs. It's pretty clear where we're going. We're going with professionals. Let me go to more callers. Angie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you so much. So one thing that has been notably absent in this discussion is criminal justice reform. And former Governor Brown was a leader on the state, moving a lot of cutting-edge reforms to look at just the fact that we've incarcerated ourselves into a very big budget issue in the state of California. So I'm just wondering where the Governor Newsom would stand on this and how all of you feel about some of these issues, particularly as where a lot of our money has gone to incarceration law enforcement.
Well, let's get an outline from you, Scott, on this, if we could. Scott Schaefer?
Yeah, I think certainly Gavin Newsom embraces almost all of the criminal justice reforms that Jerry Brown has embraced, and some that he hasn't. For example, the needle exchange bill, which would have given San Francisco, which is not really criminal justice, but in a way, you know, drug use is criminalized and dealt with as a street crime. I think you'll see that bill come back. And I realize there are other problems with that in terms of the federal government. But I think you're going to see Gavin Newsom very open to all kinds of reforms, including bail reform, which was signed by the governor, but which is now being held up through a referendum that'll be on the ballot next year. But yes, I think you're going to see a very much a continuation and maybe even a leaning in to go beyond what Governor Brown did. And, you know, there are some who feel like, whoa, let's tap the brakes here. We've done enough. But let's see how all these things, but Prop 47, realignment, Prop 57. I mean, there have been a lot of very big changes made. But I do think that this governor will, Governor Newsom, will continue that down that path for sure.
How's that square with you, Sean Walsh? Well, you've just heard Scott outline.
I think Scott's spot on with regards to the reforms. I didn't agree and still to this day don't agree with the reforms. I think there's a lot of people call them nuisance crimes, but, you know, car smash-ins and people out on the streets. And for better or worse, that you Scott hit the nail on the head, or Mary did, with regards to Daryl Steinberg's chief of staff going into the legislative side. I think Daryl's passionate about mental health. I think if you're going to spend your money, that's a lot of money should be spent there, because a lot of the problems that are in San Francisco and other places stem from mental health, and then they in the past were just dumped in the jails. But that said, I'm not sure how much, quote unquote, more criminal reform you can actually do. I think Gavin's freebie here, which was discussed earlier, is if he wants to make a national attention and a national splash, would it be very, very significant gun control types of legislation. I think a lot of it would be actually killed if it got to the U.S. Supreme Court with regards to the Second Amendment. But at a minimum, he can be a national player on gun control and gun reform issues, and then, you know, sate the appetite of some of his constituents and the Democrats in taking those efforts on.
Again, Sean Walsh is a Republican strategist with Wilson Walsh Consulting. And the next caller joining us is Neil. Neil, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, I was wondering if anybody in either party had considered reopening the mental hospitals whose closure began the homeless problem.
Sean raised his hand.
So when I was in the Schwarzenegger administration, I ran the interagency coordinating group for chronic mental illness, and we did a year-long study with regards to how to address those issues. And that's kind of one of the big urban myths or fantasies, so that Ronald Reagan closed all the mental health hospitals and then people were dumped on the streets. I won't bore you with the history, but there was called the Lanterman-Petras Act, which decided how people were going to be treated from a mental illness perspective. There were issues that were then raised with regards to whether you could commit somebody to those institutions. They changed the policy and said we were going to put people into community-based settings, kind of homes down the street. When they tried to do that, people in the neighborhoods naturally got upset. And then eventually the policy is they got dumped into inner city cores and they weren't really treated right. So to make a long story short, that wasn't the case. Opening up broad-based mental institutions I don't think is going to happen again. A, it's too expensive. What needs to happen is in certain areas you need to have a level of what's called wraparound services, where you get these folks, you hold on to them, you clean them up, you treat them, and then you get them mental illness services, and then hopefully stabilize to the point that their families can take over. But that's where the current thinking is in a policy perspective. It's expensive, but that's, if you want to be effective, probably the way you need to go.
Well, let me thank Neil for the call, and let me go to some comments that are coming in from listeners. Chrissy writes, for example, may I go to you on this, Mary Hughes. Now that the Democrats have 2/3 supermajority, let's make changes to Prop 13. Is that plausible or in the offing?
You know, I'm not sure that it's immediately plausible. I do think people will look at it. If you look at our tax structure in the state, the pressure we put on the top 1% to produce something like 46% of our revenues is off. If anybody's read recently, I'm a basketball fan. So there have been a lot of stories about the new arrival in Los Angeles,
LeBron James.
LeBron James, and how much it cost him to move something like $24 million to move from Cleveland to California in terms of what he will pay in taxes. That's not sustainable, and it's not healthy for us. So in terms of how we tax, yes, I think we will begin to look at it. Prop 13 has always been untouchable. It's unclear to me what will make it touchable. And unfortunately, it's usually some sort of a catastrophe that enables you to take an opportunity. Right now, we're not in a bad spot. So not going to happen immediately, is likely to happen because structurally we're not able to sustain what we do. But there might be incremental movement in that direction.
Speaking about incremental movement, Scott, let me go back to you, Scott Schaefer, and get your response to a couple of comments that have come in. They both have to do with, I suppose, generation gaps is a good way to frame it. Heather says, my whole voting life, every ballot has had something about children in schools. Still, Children are underserved and teachers underpaid. I hope the Governor Newsom looks into the administrative problem with our schools and not just the funding. Also, I'd like to hear something about seniors. Seniors are being pushed out of their homes with nowhere to go. Now, keep that comment in mind for just a moment, listeners and Scott and those in the studio here. And let me read this tweet from another listener who says, young people have been screwed over by the older generations, money and property grabs and Prop 13. Can't have anything nice because the money has been sucked out and left dry, much like the environment. We could have stopped climate change, but no.
Well, if that's directed to me, Michael, you know, I wouldn't put it quite that way with those words, but I do think that younger voters are waking up to the idea that not much of the pie is left for them. And yes, when you look at things like Prop 13, that was passed in 1978, 40 years ago. And obviously, it was meant to help senior citizens who were at that time getting priced out of their homes. But now the electorate is quite different, and you've got a very different housing market, and you've got people who want to buy a home or even rent a home, but you know, let alone buy, and they're finding that they can't afford it, either the down payment or the cost of the house itself or the property taxes, because Prop 13 means that you could have two identical houses next to each other, and if you buy one today, you're going to pay property taxes based on the market rate cost of the house, where your neighbor might have a very much reduced rate because of Prop 13. So I'm not sure. I mean, Gavin Newsom has said he's open to revisiting Prop 13, but I think it would have to be part of a much larger conversation about tax reform, which Sean alluded to a few minutes ago. There is something on the ballot next year, 2020, that would create a so-called split roll where commercial property would be removed from the protections of Prop 13. That's something that's been discussed for many, many, many years. And who knows? 2020 might be the time that voters are ready to support that.
And what has Governor-elect Newsom had to say? I know it's been a priority, at least in his speeches on a number of occasions, about getting people to work, especially in this tech age we live in.
Well, I'm not sure I understand the question, but he certainly
he wants to put people to work, and people are out of work because of all the new technology.
Yeah. He loves to talk about that. I mean, his eyes light up when you talk about automation and work, the workplace of the future. I think he has had conversations with some of his friends in the tech industry because they see it coming. I mean, Sean was talking about automation of picking peppers. You know, what about truckers? You know, there's going to be driverless vehicles before too long on the roads. A lot of men who are, frankly, Trump supporters, for what it's worth, who depend on driving for a living, whether they're truck drivers or work for FedEx or UPS, whatever it might be. And those jobs, you know, could be going away. It's going to be a crisis for the workforce. And that's why education and training are so critically important, because if we're not ready for the workplace of the, you know, mid 21st century, we're going to have to find workers somewhere else. I mean, there will be jobs. They're just going to be different kinds of jobs that a lot of people aren't at this point prepared to do.
Let's talk, if we could, with you, Mary Hughes, about water and what you foresee going on with the legislature and the governor, because there's a lot of talk about scaling down the water tunnel projects, but also finding essentially more initiatives that will work for water, that will change the whole flow of water, for that matter.
Well, I think that you have seen a change in the Democratic Party and in the leadership in relationship to the Central Valley and Central California. And I think that you will find a much more a greater alliance, much more give and take on this issue. Again, I think that it's one that requires science first and feedback from the users, and not to make it a political football. So I think most of the activity that will bring forth the governor's water policy will be done outside of the legislature first, and then the policy will emerge. I don't think this will be much of a big public discussion.
Well, let me just go into that for a moment with you, Sean Walsh, because there's a good deal of concern about the Trump administration actually weakening, for example, Delta protections, as I'm sure you're well aware.
Well, the old saying, you know, whiskey's made for drinking and water's made for fighting is very true. I don't agree on your point with regards to that a lot of this will be quietly done. So I think a number of constituencies within the Democratic Party, one way to control growth is to control people's access to water. If you limit to types of water supplies, where you can get that water supply, et cetera, you can limit to where people actually can build their housing, and you can do planned urban planning in that way. Now, that may be good, it may be bad, you can have that policy discussion, but, you know, Jerry Brown tried, and Arnold Schwarzenegger tried to do a through Delta Canal with Susan Kennedy and Arnold. They couldn't get it done. Jerry couldn't get it done. There's no subsurface, or there's no above ground storage. Sykes and Temperance Flats are still lingering 30 years later. So this is a major, major issue, and it's a major issue with regards to how well and how organized the state can grow in the future. So I think it has to be addressed with regards to the Trump administration. Some of the loosening on those issues, I think, is to try and pressure off-stream storage. And I personally, I'm on the advisory board for the Public Policy Institute of California with Anna Matsasantos and others. And that is one major issue that if we don't get right is really going to impact the future of the state of California.
Well, another major issue that's on hold. We've got seconds left here. But Scott Schaefer, where are we going to go with the rail?
Well, Gavin Newsom, I think, realizes that this is not a particularly popular project and it's very troubled financially. I think what you're going to see is him look at scaling it back and creating a link between the two valleys, Silicon Valley and the Central Valley. The jobs and affordable housing are in the Central Valley, or rather, the affordable housing is in the Central Valley. And you've got jobs in the Silicon Valley. And I think you'll look at him maybe trying to revise the overall picture and get that done and see what happens down the road about getting some additional financing for the rest.
Well, thank you, Scott Schaefer. Thank you, Mary Hughes. And thank you, Sean Walsh. And stay tuned to KQED Public Radio after Forum from 11 to 1 today for live coverage of Gavin Newsom being sworn in as the California 40th governor and his inaugural speech from Sacramento. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, good luck to the governor. Good luck to all of us. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis, who believe that all people deserve access to education and culture to enrich a lifetime of exploration and learning.